You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Yeah, we're not our normal time today. It's been a crazy week. My kids have been off. They're back today at school. They were off for 3 days of snow this week. So it's been weird. I know you've been busting your hump writing a column.
Well, so. Not only that, I had my kids are in person Monday and Tuesday, both days obliterated by this snowstorm. So I've had no kids in physical school all week, and I had this big assignment that I'm doing for the Washington Monthly. Hopefully, it will go up, you know, in a day or two. I won't talk about it yet. Maybe we'll save it for next week because it covers a lot of ground, and I'll chew up a lot of time if I talk about it. But I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning the last two nights because I can't get any work done during the day. So that's why I'm particularly disheveled. I think both of our hair is really becoming quite spectacular in the pandemic.
I finally got a compliment on it today.
Really?
It's been mostly people attacking my hair on Twitter. Now, in fairness, these are like dudes who are trolls, and I really don't care what they think. But I was on Julie Mason's XM POTUS radio show today, and she threw me some love, Bill. She said that it matches my I'm paraphrasing here, but basically what she said is that although I'm in some ways like a button-down conservative guy, I've also got a little bit of a wild side and a nonconformist side. And anyway, you can go. I tweeted the interview.
Excellent.
I agree that we're both, you know, we'll call us a little edgy.
That's,
you know,
right.
We're,
that's
not
right.
We're not your mom's or your dad's Republican.
Not your mother or your father's neoliberal corporatist bootlicker.
Chill.
So it's Thursday afternoon. You have to forgive me if I missed any news in the past 2 hours because I was wrapping this piece up. But I'm much more interested in the COVID relief bill negotiations than I am in what's happening with the Republicans and Representative Green and Liz Cheney and impeachment. Yeah. That's not important.
No, but the Republican story has been going on for 5 years now, maybe longer, maybe 10. The new thing is actually a bill where we could talk about substance, right? I mean, like, it's weird, but we finally got to the point where, like, the interesting thing is the meat of public policy, because we've had 5 years of Republicans, you know,
but it's not. But I don't think it's dominating media discussion. I mean, it's getting coverage, of course. But I feel like what's going on with Green and Liz Cheney is still getting much more attention. There's still fascination with what Trump is up to. And meanwhile, this enormous bill that is chock full of money and goodies is, you know, chugging along, and there's not a lot of discussion about it, which I think is good for the bill.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, from a small D democracy standpoint, we should have a robust discussion of what's in the bill and what's the good policy and how things should be changed and whatnot. But the less heat on it, the less focus on it, the easier it is to either pass through budget reconciliation on a party line vote or actually get the 60 votes for a bipartisan bill that could go through regular order. Because
yeah. I mean,
there isn't any coordinated activity on the right to stop this thing.
Yeah. Well, and part of that is that Republicans have lost any credibility to criticize spending without being hypocrites. But part of it is, frankly, Republicans – Donald Trump trained Republicans that spending is good and that it's okay. And so I think just ideologically and also from a moral high ground standpoint, Republicans don't have what they had 10 years ago or 12 years ago when Obama came on the scene.
I think that's all true. But mind you, the Democrats were prepared and pre-rebutted expected arguments that they would become newfound proponents of austerity. All of a sudden, debt and deficits would become top of mind again because of the Democrats in charge. That's the kind of hypocrisy that we've become accustomed to with Republicans. And, you know, maybe we'll get there, but we're not seeing it yet. Consider this, Matt. It was January 29th, 2009, when Rush Limbaugh wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal attacking the Porculus. It wasn't the stimulus, it was the Porculus. And I assume he probably used the phrase on his radio show a few days prior to that. So he was already sending the signal to the troops, you are not to cooperate on this bill. This bill is by definition a progressive disaster and needs to be opposed. Trump's not doing that right now. Mitch McConnell's not doing that right now. Kevin McCarthy's not doing that right now. When Susan Collins brought 10 Republicans, enough to get the 60, to the White House, Mitch McConnell didn't say, don't you dare do that, Susan Collins. How dare you legitimize this process? He said, hey, Joe Biden, you should take these people seriously. Don't listen to your staffs who are skeptics. You know, you should really.
Getting ready to like lay into a whole litany of curse words? You were going to be like, he said, hey, Joe Biden, hey, Mitch McConnell, go. And you saw a kid walk into your office. Is that what happened there?
No, I got a kid saying you're too loud.
Oh my. So. All that, I think you're right. I mean, the contrast is stark. I think if you care about let's do the caveat here too, which is that COVID is a big deal, and I think you could be a fiscal conservative who cares about spending who also says, well, this is a global pandemic, and the government shut down businesses and said we don't want you in the marketplace necessarily. And so this is a special circumstance. And so government spending in this case isn't as bad as it might otherwise be in a different type of situation. But anyway, put that aside. I do think that, again, just to reiterate the point, I think that Donald Trump transformed the Republican Party into a more populist party. And they like spending now. And so, I mean, Paul Ryan is gone. He can't talk about the debt tackling us if we don't tackle it. I mean, he can, but he's not. He's not the speaker. So this is the Republican Party is different than it was.
Now, mind you, Democrats most Democrats and progressives who remain very mistrustful and very suspicious of Republicans, understandably so. I'm not arguing Republicans have become saints all of a sudden. But they don't see anything promising or beneficial in the Group of 10 outreach. They think it's a scam. They think it's a trap.
But trust me, Bill. I wrote a piece arguing that Biden should pursue bipartisan support, and I saw a lot of pushback from that. Right. And one of the themes is simply that you can't trust the Republicans, and they can't negotiate, won't negotiate in good faith. They don't deserve any input at all. You get on the list.
Right. And one thing that surprised me, Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo had a tweet saying that the Group of 10 was another Lucy in the football situation. And he put Susan Collins' face on the Lucy in the classic cartoon. And I responded on Twitter. I mean, look, I'm not a Collins fan. I think I've talked about here in the DMZ that I thought she failed to use her power and leverage in the Trump era to bring government more to the center. She could have thrown her weight around in judicial nominations. She could have tried to stop Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and say, you have to have a bipartisan pick here to rectify the Merrick Garland situation. She didn't do any of that. So I'm not saying, again, she's a hero. But you cannot accurately argue that she does not follow through on bipartisan negotiations. She voted for a lot of things in the Obama years. She didn't come over on Affordable Care Act, but she did on stimulus. She did on Dodd-Frank. She did on Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. She did on immigration reform, even though it didn't get held up in the House. She did the bipartisan deals last year on COVID relief. They just did a bipartisan deal in December that she was a big part
of. I mean, in fairness to the haters, Trump was president then.
But she did stuff with Obama too. I mean, so there's a knocking to put on a lot of Republicans for being obstructionist in Obama. You cannot put that knock on Susan Collins. It's just, I'm not saying I'm happy to make the argument because I'm a Collins defender. It's not defending her. It's just plain fact. She did it.
And so, Bill, I felt like the way Biden behaved, and let me be specific, Biden was nice to invite the 10 to the White House, and apparently it was very cordial and nice. However, like immediately after the meeting, Jen Psaki released this statement basically saying, thanks, but no thanks, and we're going to do this our own way. And so I felt like that was kind of very quickly rebuffing this overture. I mean, the Republicans are like, we want to help you spend $600 billion and get you to 60. And Biden ran, I think a central theme of his campaign was being a uniter, healing us, bipartisanship, working across the aisle, all of that. He's on the job for a couple weeks. He has a chance for this. 10 Republicans come to him. Now, again, in fairness, he welcomed them, but quickly rebuffed it. And I felt like that was a mistake because let me ask you, I'm not saying this poisons the well forever and that they'll never work together on anything else again, but doesn't it make it less likely that Republicans will now vote for this bill?
I would not jump to that conclusion. It's been a while since we've seen actual negotiations occur involved them. I mean, look, some negotiations happened with Trump, but they were weird negotiations. We haven't seen normal negotiations in a long time.
I don't even think I would call them negotiations. That's the wrong word.
So, and I think, look, it's totally possible that at the end of the day, Joe Biden and the group of 10 can't meet in the middle and Democrats will pass both the reconciliation on a party line vote. That totally could happen.
Did you feel that statement that they put out, like, why did they have to put that statement out? I felt like that was the problem for me.
Every bit of rhetoric coming out of the Biden White House is two-pronged. It simultaneously says that we would love to have bipartisanship, but we also have the urgency to act and need to do something very close to what Biden has initially proposed. This is trying to negotiate with leverage. They don't want to and do not need to scurry over to the Collins side. They don't have to bend over backwards and beg them for their support and give away the store on the front end. Biden has high job approval. He has high public opinion for his initial ask of $1.9 trillion. As I just said, there is no coordinated opposition to the basic concept of what Biden is doing.
That's an interesting point.
The pressure on so people who have the mistrustful conclusion that the group of 10's primary intention is to drag things out and nickel and dime Joe Biden so he passes something ineffectual or doesn't pass anything at all, I think is the wrong analysis. I'm being chastised again. There is political incentive for any politician to pass something that will be popular. And as it stands, what Biden is passing is going to be popular. Now, you know, there's always a risk. You know, Democrats need to be careful not to overreach. They shouldn't assume what's popular today is going to be popular tomorrow. You know, you could pass something with a ton of money in it, and people get mad that's not distributed fairly or effectively. But I think in this case, whatever gets passed, vaccinations will eventually happen. The pandemic will eventually end and the economy will rebound in some way. It's not 2009. It's not a financial crisis, which are notoriously suffer from slow recoveries. This will likely have a more rapid recovery. So if you're Susan Collins, or if you're Mike Rounds in South Dakota, or Tom Tillis in North Carolina, and no one is in your grill telling you not to do this, why not do it? And if you're inclined to do it on those grounds, Biden can say, well, you got to come my way. I don't have to come your way. You have to come my way. Now, Biden has some interest in getting to 60. You don't get to do reconciliation bills every day. He doesn't automatically have a hard 50 for whatever he wants to do. You know, Joe Manchin is already saying, I'm not going to do $15 minimum wage. When you do something by yourself, you risk having those divisions get exposed. And then whatever things go wrong is wholly on your watch and not on the Republicans' watch. Yeah. So if he can save reconciliation for something else down the line, and if he can start with a fulfilling of the bipartisan pledge, he'd be happy to do that. He's not going to do it to the extent that he'd sacrifice what he thinks is a necessary bill.
Okay, let me stop you on that. And I think you're right in terms of your analysis. But two things. One, I assume that there will be, if people like Collins having gone and tried to negotiate with Biden and having been rebuffed, if they end up voting for a $1.9 trillion or whatever deal, I am assuming that some conservative opposition will materialize eventually to some degree to push back against that. But my larger problem is, when are we going to get around to bringing people together? Like, I felt like the most compelling argument Joe Biden made the entire campaign, and now I'm like talking lower, I'm afraid your daughters are going to come in and yell at me. We're having a sleepover. For me, the most compelling argument Biden had was like, don't beat Trump. I'm going to return to normalcy. We're going to work together again. You know, all those things. To me, that was the most appealing part of Biden. And so maybe in my mind, that was sort of his central promise, even more than COVID, because COVID is going to go away. But we have this other problem, which is that democracy is in trouble in America. And like, that's a big challenge, too. And I felt like Biden was tasked to fix that. And if you have, you're on the job for just a couple weeks, and the Republicans, 10. Imagine if Barack Obama had 10 Republicans who came to him and said, I want to help spend $600 billion. By the way, we just spent $900 billion last month. So let's do $600 billion more. You know, you've got 10 Republicans who come to you and want to work with you, and your answer is like, well, I'd like for you to vote with me, but hey, I won the election. We're doing it our way.
But he hasn't said that. I mean, there hasn't been an Obama, Eric Cantor, I won moment. He said, I'm glad he met with them in the White House before he met with the Democrats. And he said, let's have our staffs keep talking and see what we can come up with. But he's also saying, I'm not going to dilly-dally and wait until this comes to fruition. I'm going to move. You know, there's a version of the corn pop story that Biden gave, I think it's 2006. I'm going to read this here, okay?
Every once in a while when we're talking, I know exactly where the suits at Blogging Heads are going to, like, put the leg. And it's going to be, there's a version of the corn pop story. That's going to be like, when you click the link, you're going to get that. So, yeah.
So this is what Biden said. So Corn Pop and some of his guys are waiting in my car for me with their straight razors. Remember, this is Biden at the pool.
And he's a lifeguard in Wilmington.
He's a lifeguard, and they were doing something in the pool they weren't supposed to be doing. So Corn Pop and some of his guys are waiting in my car for me with their straight razors. I say to the maintenance man, look, let's call the park police. He says, you do that, you might as well quit. I said... I said, man, I'm not going to go out there. So he took me out to the boiler room, got a great big roll of chain, and cut off 6 feet, and said, wrap it around your arm, put a towel over it, and you go out and tell them you're going to wrap that goddamn chain around their head.
Why didn't the maintenance guy do this? If it's such a great idea, maybe the maintenance guy should have handled that.
Biden's got to fight his own fights, you know? He's got to
stand up. But he's telling him how to handle it. Let me explain to you how to handle these gang members.
So he's watching. Everyone's watching. What am I going to do? I go out, 6'1", 155 pounds, right? I walk out. They creak their straight razors open. So I take off the towel and I say, Corn Pop, you may cut me, but I'm going to wrap this chain around your head and hurt you. Or that's what I was supposed to say. That's Scoop Jackson. But here's what I said. I was wrong in calling you out, Corn Pop. You were wrong jumping on the board, and I should have thrown you out. But I shouldn't have called you Esther. Esther was his real name.
Yeah.
He looked at me. You apologize for calling me Esther. Okay. Puts up his razor, goes home. The point is, you got to be prepared to use the chain, but there's other ways to do it. So I think that's exactly what's happening here. Reconciliation is the chain. He's prepared to use the chain. It's right there for everyone to see. But if he can get the 60, he's going to take the 60.
I'm going to cut that up and tweet that out. That's great. I'm serious. We need to edit that. That's a great story. That would have been... that's a column, man.
Maybe.
I like that.
So what's just interesting to me, obviously we don't want to treat this stuff like it's all, you know, fun and games. There's real people's lives at stake here. But, like, I think that there's real complicated negotiations and dynamics going on right now. I mean, I'm just talking now about Joe Biden and the Group of Ten. There's also Joe Manchin. And
the Group of Two.
Well, who's the two?
Him and Sinema. Well, Manchin and Sinema.
You know, Sinema is her own enigma because she has said basically nothing. Like, we have no idea if she has things she wants, if she has cards she wants to play. Manchin at least talks.
Right. Well, she did say about the filibuster that she wouldn't.
There's a filibuster. Yeah. She's not, you know, there was a group of 16 before the group of 10. Group of 16 of 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans. Sinema's not in that. I don't know why she's not in that. Sinema just confuses me completely. I have no idea what she wants, what her angle is, what her endgame is. Manchin has asserted himself to say, I'm number 50. You go through me. But all we know of what he wants is that he wants more targeted payments. He wants the $1,400 payments to go to more lower-income people. And he has said that he doesn't want $15 minimum, that for West Virginia, 11 makes more sense. And generally speaking, he wants bipartisan input, which you can interpret to say he wants 60 or that he just wants nominal bipartisan input for reconciliation. He's leaving both options open. He voted for the budget resolution bill, which is the precursor to reconciliation, and has left that door open as well. So I find some Democrats look at Manchin and say, oh, he's never going to sink the bill. He's a Democrat at heart. West Virginia is a populist state. He hasn't insisted on 60, even when we talk about bipartisanship, so you don't have to worry about him. But, and I agree, I don't think he wants to sink it. But you don't know where he's going to draw a line and say, I'm not going to let you do this. I mean, he's basically indicating, I'm not going to let you do $15 minimum wage. I'm not going to let you do targeted payments to, you know, to higher income people. And are there other things he's going to draw lines on? I just don't know, because I think he's just he's a cagey guy. He's maybe not as cagey as Sinema, who I know absolutely nothing about. And there's also Angus King. Angus King said in the initial Group of 16 meeting, this is a monopoly money. So, you know, he doesn't like the price tag. He did a podcast with Lisa Murkowski last week talking about his hopes to get to 60, though not really talking too much about particulars. Are there other folks lurking out there who are going to wave their hand and say, you know what, I don't like this part or that part? I mean, anyone at any time can say that's not okay with me. So Manchin's just the one who's more open, who has more latitude to go against the grain. because he's not going to get hammered at home for doing that. And the thing that's sort of left unsaid is that if you squeeze Manchin too hard, he can leave.
Please don't squeeze the Manchin.
That was my column for Real Politics. I mean, like, I don't think he wants to be a Republican. Like, I mean, if I were Manchin, I was really pissed off. You know, what I would do is I'd become an independent. I caucus the Republicans and say, you know, Democrats, you stop treating me like dirt, I'll come back. I can go back and forth. But I decide whether Chuck Schumer has control of the floor or Mitch McConnell has control of the floor.
Did you see Kamala Harris did a newscast, or she did an interview with a news station here in West Virginia?
Yep.
That
did you watch? Is that your local routine at home? You watch the local news?
No, I just heard about it. I didn't see it. I'm not 80 years old, Bill.
Well, the thing about that, if you watch the interview, and look, yeah, I've been pretty pro Kamala on the show and in my writing. I thought she'd be VP. I thought she was the right choice for VP. I think she's very well suited, really well set up to be the nominee after Joe Biden, whenever that happens. I think she has time to build a relationship in, you know, interior states where she's not as well known at this point. But that was a bad interview. Like, yeah. Even if Manchin didn't say anything at all about it, she did a bad job. She was not sharp talking about the coal issue.
The landmines, Bill.
Right. And that undercut her ability to say something that potentially could have put more pressure on Joe Manchin. There was no pressure put on Joe Manchin through that interview. Maybe the intention was to do so, but it wasn't successful.
I don't think they have any leverage. I don't think there's any scenario where Kamala Harris puts pressure on Joe Manchin in West Virginia.
Well, that's right. And I also found people.
But even if she brought her A game, I don't think there's a scenario.
Right. And now it's not quite the same, but when Governor Jim Justice said, we got to go big here, and everyone was like, oh, game.
I care if we waste money. Hell, right. Spend it all.
Everyone's like, game, set, match. Joe Manchin's got to do what Jim Justice tells him to do. I'm like, Joe Manchin does not have to do what anybody tells him to do. He owes nothing to nobody. He is in his 70s. He's not up for re-election until 2024. He might not run again. He could quit before then. There's no donor and no individual politician of Justice who switched parties. You know, he wasn't an organized Republican. He doesn't owe Jim Justice anything. So I just don't think those are I can't tell you what exactly is driving Joe Manchin's calculations, but as I would say, he might just believe certain things, and he has the power and the latitude to act on those beliefs.
Yeah, I think so. I kind of like it. I'm digging this. Digging this special love. Did you see the guy with the Florida tattoo, like right between his eyes?
No.
And this is like serious, man. There's a Florida man who has a. I'm thinking of getting the West Virginia. Oh, right. It's like a big middle finger at everybody.
So I think you have these very complicated, potentially complicated dynamics. I think Biden is handling things very well. I mean, it was smart to go big. It was smart to have a big ask. You know, Chuck Schumer. You know, Chuck Schumer sounds even less excited about bipartisanship than maybe Biden does in certain moments. We take out certain quotes, but you know, Schumer is there. Like Schumer is not the person at this point tasked to be the guy to cut the bipartisan deal. He'll be the guy to have to sell a bipartisan deal to reluctant Democrats if that happens. But Biden and Manchin are the ones who are having the most interaction with Republicans, not Schumer. So the fact that Schumer is drawing a hard line, I mean, he's there to help with the leverage. He's there to say, look, I got these Democrats ready to do something if you don't come our way. But the fact that Biden and Manchin keep that door open, I do not think is insignificant. And I would not assume that I don't assume group attendance for show. I don't assume Biden's bipartisan outreaches for show. And we just have to see how this all plays out. But people should not misalign their expectations. If Democrats are saying to themselves, Republicans are a joke, the offer is an insult, and I see that Biden and Manchin are giving it proper disparagement, therefore I assume I'm going to get everything that I want and believe should happen. And then that doesn't happen. Then you become very angry and frustrated. Why didn't this happen the way I thought it was going to happen? The Democrats must be giant sellouts. They must be totally incompetent. And that's why I think it's people look at me when I make these analyses and think I'm being biased. I have this fetish for bipartisanship, therefore I'm seeing things that should not be seen. And I'm trying to say, I'm not telling you bipartisanship's going to happen. It might not. But don't discount the possibility, because there are all these reasons why it could happen. I'm not going to be shocked either way. You might be shocked if it goes the other way, and it might lead you to say very angry things about Democrats that actually might undermine their political standing after that point.
Well, I hate to do it, Bill, but we should probably keep this one short and sweet.
All right.
So theoretically, we will DM Zoom tomorrow, right?
DM Zoom tomorrow. We work out of time in a little bit, but always good to talk to you here in the DMZ. If you're not yet a Patreon supporter of ours,
you should be.
You can do so, and that will get you into the VIP DMZ Zooms.
DMZ well. Plus.
I'll talk to you tomorrow, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right. See you guys.